TuxJam, combining Linux news with Creative Commons goodness.
Hello and welcome to a TuxJam special for HPR. Again, after the success and positive comments of the last one, we decided that we'd do another one, and this was a slightly special one along the theme of how we got onto Linux. And we're also numbering this episode 33 and a third. And I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Kevy. How are you, Kevy?
Hello, hello. And a great big hello to actually all everybody out there in HPR land. I am very well. And this, you guys are in for a treat purely because anybody on the normal TuxJam feed is not going to get this. This is going to be an exclusive episode. Yeah, so all the juicy gossip of how Kevy and Andrew got into Linux. Ooh. Now, I was told that this was supposed to be the very first HPR episode you're supposed to release going by tradition, but hopefully people will forgive us for doing this second.
Indeed, and I've released lots of other episodes of non-TuxJam stuff and never actually done that episode. So, yeah, I'm sure they will forgive us. I mean, it's not that formal a place, HPR.
Very good, very good. Now, those of you who do normally listen to TuxJam, then they'll know that, you will know, that TuxJam always stands out a wee bit different as being very Linuxy and open source related, but with quite a lot of music, not just a track here and a track at the end. So we're going to go straight in with this because otherwise we're going to end up having a fully talk show. So we don't want that. You don't want to do that. bad Hattie Hinfield impression there. So we're going to start with the first track, and it's by Xenia Nen, and it's Just the Way I'm Feeling.
It's so complicated, too much to think about. Everything's changing, the world turns upside down. Such a strange feeling, feet off the ground, turn around. Never turn around. To tell you, the words just don't come out. You won't understand me, you always let me down. Why should I care now? How can I stay? Get out, go away. Oh, for you. Just like a game, you find it so amusing. Before it gets too late, you don't know what you're losing. I don't care if it hurts, so this is it, I'm living. I can't go on like this, it's just the way.
Turns out it's time to
And now for the first of tonight's interviews, I am going to invite Andrew to take the hot seat.
Ooh, that is hot.
Okay then, would you like an ice pack for that?
I think so. I think I'll take the gold seat for a bit.
Fair enough, fair enough. Right then, well, this is all about Linux and how we got into it. So, what was your first, let's just say, what was the first time you heard of Linux, even maybe even before you started using it?
Yeah, only very shortly before I started using it. I was, let's see, now I've written this down. But not in the place that's in front of me. But I can date it back to when I was at Glasgow University. And the machine, I was in an astronomy department and it was full of very expensive sun machines. And I, for some reason, I think it was my dad had suggested, oh, you could buy a Pentium PC, which were pretty new at the time. So that dates it. And it must have been about 93 or 94. Maybe 95, actually. It must be 95, sorry. Yeah. And, he said you could buy for £1,000, which is still quite a lot of money for a computer, you could buy a Pentium and you could stick Linux on it and you'll be really impressed. You'll have a machine that, you know, can keep up with all those £10,000, £20,000, £30,000 Sun workstations that your department has. So that was my first, I think that was the first time I'd heard about Linux.
And did your dad give you a recommendation or did he just leave it the open-ended Linux statement?
No. Now, I think most people would be used to trying to get their parents into computers. I should point out my dad has been working with computers since the 60s. So he was very much the expert. I was so new to doing anything with computers back then. With anything serious with them. You know, I did do a bit of programming and stuff, but I'd never meddled with an operating system before. So he came along with, I guess it was a stack of floppies still back then, and installed, I think it was Slackware 3 point something. Maybe in 2, but maybe Slackware. I think it was Slackware 3 point something onto this Pentium machine when it arrived at my desk.
And how were your initial thoughts on it as far as usability goes? How did it compare to what you were using in uni? Were your skills very easily transferable or was it quite a steep learning curve?
Well, that's a very good question because, of course, back in that time, this was pre-Windows 95 era, really. So my only experience of Microsoft stuff was Windows 3.1, and that was absolutely laughable compared to the Macs at the time, which the university library had, and especially the really swanky Sun workstations, you know, with their X Windows, and I think we had Motif, Sunos, and Solaris was just coming along, so it was all very shiny stuff at the time. And I have to say, Linux, it was x386, X Windows. I guess it was FVWM. That was the window manager I would have had because this was pre GNOME or KDE, I would believe. Certainly, I don't remember them being around at the time. And it looked basic, but it was very comparable with what I was used to on the Sun workstations, and in fact, in some ways, better because not only did I have a very fast machine for computations, which is why I got it, but I was the only person in the office that could listen to music using a program called Workbone on my PC. Nobody else could do that.
Oh, excellent. So you were almost like you were flying the flag for it from a very early stage. What problems did you encounter in the early days?
Well, I can remember the installation procedure. I had not a clue. My dad sat there and he was very patient. And this is nothing like the installation of any operating system, especially Linux now. It was a really tough ride. But my dad had done it before, so I watched with bemusement as he went through it. The only time I remember him getting stuck was configuring x386, which was the granddaddy of Xorg. So essentially, you had to code all these your monitor refresh rates into these things called mode lines, which was in the equivalent of the xorg.com file. I forget what it was called, probably x f 80 x 386.com for something like that, I forget. And it was quite difficult to get those mode lines right, get those refresh rates right, and there's also the risk that you may fry your monitor if you got it wrong. I remember that was mentioned a few times. But other than that, I think it was pretty straightforward.
Now, just out of curiosity here, I'm just thinking, going back to Windows 3.1 days, now certainly from my experience, that was kind of before a time when, you know, many people had access to the internet at all. So what were the big draws for Linux at that time?
You mean the advantages of using Linux at that time?
Not so much the advantage. What drew you to it in the first place? I mean, I certainly know, like I said, the security was one of the huge things that drew me. But obviously that probably wouldn't have been that big an issue back then before. I mean, I'm assuming we're talking about a time before the internet was connected to the PC 24/7.
Oh, well, at the university at that time, since... Oh, goodness. Since at least 1992, probably 1990, I was used to working with always-on internet PCs in universities. I guess in some kind of sense, universities had that in the UK through what we call the Janet network. So that wasn't at all novel. That was old hat for me by that point. What was new was the fact that for £1,000, you could have something running this Linux operating system that outperformed, I don't remember the prices, but a tens of thousands of pounds Sun workstation. That, to me, was the thing that turned heads as much as being able to listen to my CDs easily enough. So it was actually getting the raw computing power out of the machine, having the power of a Unix-like operating system for a very low price. That was what really swung it, because, you know, universities, well, at least my experience of astronomy at universities, is that you don't have a lot of money to play with for your computational resources. Certainly doesn't seem to be as much back then as you might think universities might have had.
Okay, right, so yeah, you've answered my question there. What about, I'm thinking, one of the big problems of getting anybody over nowadays is, well, one of the big arguments is always about software, and software not being that readily available. That's not necessarily true, but how was it back then? I mean, were things quite in kind of beta stage, alpha stage? Was it kind of quite buggy, or was there quite a large supply of software already there?
It was, I remember it being very stable, you know. I remember that machine running for months, maybe years, without ever going down unless I told it to. And you may remember that Pentiums were prone to overheating, so that was no mean feat at the time. It was a very impressive piece of kit. So as for applications, well, I mean, this is pre-Microsoft Office dominance. As for like web browser, I mean the web's in its infancy. The web's only a year or two old. So I think I was using NCSA Mosaic at first, and then it probably was Netscape. I'm pretty sure it was Netscape I was using for my web browser, and it was stable. I actually remember the very first time on the Sun workstation, and must have been 92 or 93, somebody said, come and look at this, it's the World Wide Web, it's amazing, you can click on bits of text, and it takes you to another bit of text that explains those words, you know, there was hyperlinks in other words, and this person was enthusing, and I went through to the computer room, and this extremely expensive workstation, and he went, look at this, and he clicked on the link, and the whole of NCSA Mosaic just crashed, and I laughed and said, that's rubbish, went back to my desk.
Yes, yeah, so even back then you had become a zealot, you know, a Linux zealot, so you would be saying, ah, that's rubbish, look, I've been doing that for ages. Yes. So did you stick with Slackware for your entire computing days since then, or should I say Linux days? Because I know you still currently use it.
Yes, well, this is where I have to make my confession, Father Kevy. What happened was, by the late 90s, a lot of people I was working with, even in academia, were starting to be seduced to the dark side and using Microsoft Word, and I was getting Word files attached to emails. And it also, when you went to buy a laptop, it came with Microsoft Windows 98 on it. You didn't get a choice. You had to jump through a lot of hoops to put Linux on it. So I got a laptop with Windows 98 on it, and I'm sorry to say that for a good few years I used Microsoft Windows and Microsoft Office, and there was no OpenOffice back then as well to give you an alternative. So there was that. But I didn't give up on Linux completely. I moved to the Open University, and I said, look, I can't actually do my research without a Unix-type operating system. And there was a few things like C programs that I ran to do number crunching, and some NASA data that I worked with. So I got a laptop that dual booted into Red Hat, and early, you know, pre-Red Hat Enterprise Linux, original Red Hat, and it had no, I remember I never liked that very much. I was never happy with that Linux, Red Hat Linux. It was just, yeah, I didn't feel at home at all, although it probably was superior to my first outing with Slackware, you know, given that it was good 5 years later at least. And then I carried on in this dark place into the 2000s, and I think I made the switch back in about 2003. I went back to Linux. But the interesting thing was, the thing that got me back into Linux was not that it was superior to Windows. In fact, in many ways, you could argue that it was actually a hindrance in my day-to-day life because of all the Microsoft-y Office stuff that I had to deal with. But I actually read The Cathedral and the Bazaar by ESR, Eric Raymond, and I started to read stuff by Richard Stallman. And so it was the FOSS element of Linux, which I'd never understood before, to be fair. I'd used Linux a lot. I'd never really appreciated how it was put together. When I realized that, I was hooked, and that drew me back in, and I never looked back. And I returned to Slackware. It was actually my dad, again, who literally offered me a Slackware 11 disk and said, try this. And I did. And I don't think at the time I recalled that it was Slackware that I used in the beginning. I didn't make the connection until a while afterwards.
No, that's clearly quite a big jump. So you went from roughly 2 or 3 to up to 11. I mean, did you know that it was Slackware? Did you know it was the same operating system? Or at the time, did you just think, this is a just completely new and updated system? There's almost no connection apart from the fact it's Linux-based.
Oh, it was night and day. I mean, it really was. I mean, Slackware 11, which came with one of the mature versions of KDE 3, was so much better than the Red Hat with GNOME that I'd used many years before, admittedly, and a lot better than the very rudimentary stuff that I'd been using back in the mid-90s, my first outing with Slackware. I should say that I don't think I was all... Yeah, well, I say I wasn't aware of the FOSS aspect of the free GNU underpinnings of Linux back in the 90s. I didn't appreciate that. I'm not entirely sure I went around saying, by the way, I use Linux. I think it was just, I might have even called it Linux back then. You know, it didn't matter. It was a bit like saying, it was of no real interest to me any more than saying, oh, I use a 3-pin wall socket to plug my plugs into. You know, it really was like that. I didn't care. I was just using what worked best.
Yes, which actually... many people could say, okay, the freedom lovers are going to hate me for saying this, but to be honest, that's almost like what's come with the likes of Android now. You know, I mean, people who actually use it, unless they're really into it, don't really care. They're just thinking, oh, it's what suits me best. And in many ways, that's what I think. When people use Linux for that reason, it's a major win. That's the way I personally feel, because they're not actually going for it for a belief system or, you know, any moral values. They're purely going for it because it is the better system.
Yes, it was certainly like that. And so I feel my journey was a bit backwards in a sense that I start, you know, backwards in that not quite the way other people encountered Linux. Is that I feel that a lot of people are drawn to Linux by its freedom associations, whereas with me it was almost the other way around. It was just because it was a better operating system back then, because Windows wasn't was very immature and rubbish in the mid 90s until Windows 95. Basically, Windows was just rubbish.
Yeah, I'd still say that it's still pretty rubbish, really. Unfortunately, I'm forced to use it at work, but that doesn't stop me taking my laptop in and using that for most of my day-to-day stuff.
Yes, well, I have to say that the if I was to rate Windows, it probably peaked somewhere for me, Windows 2000, Windows XP, and then descended. And so with retrospect, I could even argue that, yeah, the peak was fairly rubbish in a number of ways, but mostly in a freedom sense.
Yes, that's true. Windows has never been one to embrace freedom, not at all. Right then, so that's actually interesting. That's taken us from right from the very start, right the way through to present day. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Well, not really, other than, as you mentioned, I still use Slackware, and I've played around with a load of different Linux distros, including Ubuntu and Unity, and I have to say, I get on well with all of them. I used Ubuntu Unity for 6 months, but I do keep going back to Slackware. You know, I have a CentOS server running in an old EPC in the cupboard to my left, and it's fine. It doesn't bother me. It doesn't need rebooted. It needs very little maintenance other than some occasional upgrades. But when it does come time to tinker with it, I do wish I was dealing with Slackware. Maybe because I know Slackware the best after all these years.
Yes, well, that's it. I mean, some of the times, you know, it is just down to what you're, if you're very used to something, if you're very comfortable with something, then that's what you like. You know, it doesn't necessarily matter if, you know, it's necessarily bad or worse. It's just different, and you're just maybe more comfortable with the route you know. I think that's probably true for most of us.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary. So that's me, I think, going on about my Linux history long enough. Time for a tune, do you think?
Yes, I think so. And this is by A Beautiful Tomorrow, and the track is All I Wanna Be Is Happy. Happy.
just give all I wanna be and set me. I just want a life to live.
Welcome back. I hope you enjoyed that tune. Now it's someone else's turn to go in the hot seat. Okay, if you don't mind the electrodes, that's just for extra warmth. Just keep you nice and toasty in the hot seat. Are you ready?
Yes, I'll grin and bear it. Give me a minute. I'm putting the factor 50 on my thighs here.
That's too much information.
Right then, I am well planted in this very, very hot seat. In fact, I'm pouring this cup of tea on it to cool down.
Okay, so what was your first Linux distribution?
Well, actually, I don't know, to be honest. Now, you may think that's really odd, but my first Linux distribution, believe it or not, was on the Xbox.
The Xbox?
Yeah, I was just waiting for that reaction.
Sorry, the Microsoft Xbox.
Yes, correct, yes. I never really, to be honest, I'd never heard of, I didn't know that, like many people probably still today, I didn't know there were too many alternatives to Windows. I'd used Mac, and in school I'd used Acorns, and Windows, and I'd never really heard of too many other different ones. And the thing that got me into Linux, or initially started off my path to Linux, was Microsoft's greed and closed downness of the Xbox. And that is actually how, believe it or not, I came to find out about, as my mate described it, Linux, as most people probably started their life calling it.
Yes, indeed, I did as well. So how, I mean, is it not, it strikes me as quite a difficult way to start. Is it not difficult to install it on an Xbox?
Well, the reason being, I'll actually tell you why, like, I even found out about it, was because I'm quite a big fan of American football. And there's always been the Madden series in the UK. But if you actually want to get into it a bit more, then you can go, there's a college game, there's the NCAA college football, there's the Arena League football game, all those ones. I don't actually think the Arena League one's still being developed, but they all fit together nicely. So in other words, if you had a game like with the college one and you saved it through and then you played Madden, you could actually pick up the college players that you played as in Madden. So it worked, you know, it worked really well. But the Xbox was horribly locked down, and I got these games, and lo and behold, I suddenly realised, oh, wait a minute here, these are coded. I cannot play them, they're region coded. So I looked up online, thought, right, how do I get round this? And my mate, who I just happened to notice, he was a real computer guy. I remember he was a computing teacher, but he went way beyond teacher level. He was really seriously into computers, and I said to him, right, do me a favour. I says, I noticed you've got an Xbox that does not look like stock. I says, what is it? And he says, oh, that's a chipped and it's running Linux. I says, what's Linux? And he says, oh, it's a different operating system. And I says, will you do that to mine? He says, yes. And he came along and put on this distro for me. He didn't seem to do a heck of a lot as far as installing the distro. It seemed pretty quick. But it was the most difficult part, I would say, was he had to open up the Xbox and put in the Executor 3. I remember that. Executor 3 chip. And that probably was the most difficult part. And then he flashed it and flashed the Xbox and it worked. And I thought, wow, what an amazing amount of extra features that were never included before. So it essentially turned an Xbox from a gaming machine into a heck of a lot more. So that was my very first experience.
And so you could now play other Xbox games on this chipped, souped-up Xbox?
Yes, well, the main reason I did it was because I was really wanting just to play the region, the games from North America. Because on top of anything else, at the time, when they first came out, the Xbox games weren't a heck of a lot of them, but the ones that were here were really expensive. Now, Madden came out, and I think it was, this is going back to 2004, Madden 2005 came out, and it was, I think it was £50 in the UK. Now, I got Madden and NCAA, both of them, sent over, now legitimately, not through eBay or anything, but it was from a legitimate store that would post overseas, a lot of them wouldn't, and I got them both for, I think it was £32. It was a heck of a saving, even if I didn't want the other one, just even on just the Madden game, but it was for both of them, and it was really was a big saving, because also the other thing I'd noticed was the there was an awful lot of games came out that, in America that just never made it over here.
Oh, so that sounds like a bit of a jump forward so that you could open up your gaming experience. But on a technical level, what I'm wondering is, didn't the Xbox run Windows? So how did these Windows, or something like Microsoft Windows you'd expect, so how did these Windows games run on something that now was Linux?
To be honest, I have no idea, because I just, as far as I was concerned, I used quite a few of the new features. It gave me quite a lot of different features, in fact. And I just kept on playing games, and to be honest, that was all I used it for, and that was my first experience, or no in full experience of it. However, I didn't actually put two and two together to think, oh, the Xbox is Windows, well, wait a minute, this must mean that my computer has got, you know, I could maybe try this on the computer. So that was 2004, so it actually took me another 3 years before I actually attempted to install. By this point, I had been told it is not Linux, it's Linux. So 2007 was the first time I had actually installed it.
And you remember what you installed it back in 2007?
Yes, I do. It was the very first one I installed was SUSE. And I can't remember exactly what number it was, but to be honest, I knew about it, about Linux, and I didn't know which ones were which. And I got an old laptop somebody had given me, and I thought, wait a minute. You know, and I looked it up online. I was reading about this Linux, and I'm thinking, oh, okay. And someone recommended me, go for SUSE. It's a good starter distro. And I got it installed very, very easily. I really liked it. But the big problem I had was the drivers for this laptop did not work. So I couldn't get the modem working at all. I just didn't seem to get any internet connectivity with it. So that, unfortunately, brought my very first attempt at installing Linux to a kind of abrupt end. So after a week of failing to get find an appropriate driver, I kind of gave up there. But I wasn't ready to give up quite yet.
Ah. Well, I mean that is quite an interesting story. So you came from the Xbox using a more mainstream distro, but then were thwarted by a driver problem. So what did you do after that?
Well, after that, I had actually been speaking to somebody else, and this was speaking to them in the flesh, rather than just online. And they said to me, he says, "What did you use?" And I said, "SUSE." And he says, no. He says, "That's great for somebody that knows a bit about it." But he says, you're a virgin, more or less, as far as Linux goes. He says, "There's a distro called Ubuntu." He says, "Go and try that." And I thought, okay then. And I installed it, and it was 7.10. That was my very first distro I installed. And I was utterly amazed. Everything worked. I mean, the one thing that I had heard of with Linux, the main problems I'd from what people have been saying on the grapevine, of course, and all this was, oh, you'll spend most of your life in a terminal. That's not good for a Windows person. There's no programs, and any programs that you do have are very, they're all homemade, and they're just a pile of rubbish. And at that time, Ubuntu was pretty stock GNOME 2 desktop. And I started playing about with this, thought, oh, I really like this. It came with quite a few programs installed, and I was really impressed with just the range. And also then, it had a software, like its own version of the software center. Nothing was like now. It was actually quite a nice thing. I quite liked it back then. It was a simple, quick thing. It was almost like maybe a better version of... closest thing I could describe it to is, in modern days, probably a better version of Fedora's Yum GUI. It actually was It was nice and it was quick to use. Nothing like as big and bloated as the Ubuntu Software Center it is presently.
Was that the one that had, had all these different levels of repos that would say multiverse and so forth? Was it that one?
Yes, aye, and it had some graphics and had wee icons, but certainly there was nothing flash about it, and it didn't slow down your machine to a complete halt.
Yeah, I remember my first experience of that, because it's quite unlike anything that I was used to in Slackware, and it was quite good, but I couldn't really get my head around all the ideas of different repositories and why there were some things in one repository and other things in other repositories and, you know, why. I remember being totally baffled by that. I found what I wanted, obviously, but I never quite got my head around that.
Well, to be honest, I came from, like I said, a Windows background there, and I hadn't had my smartphone at that point. So this whole App Store thing was totally new to me. So actually, to be honest, I hadn't anything to compare it to, and I quite liked it, and I thought, wow, this is brilliant. So, you know, you're going through and you're looking through all of these. Now, it seemed to be the extreme opposite from Windows, purely because it was a case of, with anything I used to do with Windows, you had to go and install it, you had to go find it, sorry, then install it, then you had to go through a bunch of questions, then you always end up installing that blooming thing that would add something to your browser, despite the fact you never told it to, and then it was all stuff running in the background. So I thought, wow, this is utterly amazing. That was my kind of first usable, let's just say, experience of Linux on the desktop. And I have to give credit, Ubuntu was the one that convinced me. As far as why I went there, it was purely down to the fact that I've always been one for, I'm always been a believer in sharing is caring, you know. And on Windows, that's really not a sensible option to take. And I used to spend a fortune on security and firewalls and things, but I used to quite regularly get viruses. And this time, what had actually happened was I got this virus and I could not get rid of it, and it really just took my system down. And so I reinstalled Windows, and I was like, oh, this takes forever. Oh my word, this was so slow. And then I was trying out a similar piece of software, and it happened again. And I thought, you know what? Forget it, I'm through with this. I do not want to go through this again. And I actually spoke to my neighbour, who's an older guy, but he had never tried it. And I said to him, what about Linux? He says, there's too many flavours. I haven't a clue what even to start with. So when I'd actually heard about the Ubuntu, we both actually tried it then. And that was actually what got me into it in the very first place.
So it must be a very enlightened place. The Isle of Lewis where you live. I'm not sure anyone in my entire street would know what I was talking about, even still if I start asking them about Linux or Linux or anything like that.
Well, that's actually one thing that people always get surprised at. You know, people, forget about fashion trends and things like that. That's not up here. But when it comes to computing, we really do have quite a good knowledge base for the majority. And I think it's purely because you kind of have to, because if you don't and you just like limit yourself, for example, for just what you can get in town, you really are kind of getting yourself into, well, basically you're limiting what you can get, and also you're putting your price up. And also the other thing is, we as Islanders, you get what's called the air discount scheme and the road equivalent tariffs and things like that. Now, with the air discount scheme, you can only apply for that, as far as I know, if you do it online. So if you basically, it almost takes about a third off your flight bill if you want to go away, if you have your ADS card. So unless you get into the computer side of things, you know, you can't use that. And that goes for anybody, whether they're, you know, 6 or 106, they're going to have to actually use it.
Indeed. And I should at this point out to listeners who are not familiar with TuxJam or Kevin and I, that I live in Glasgow, in the central belt of Scotland, and Greater Glasgow has, I don't know, about 2 million people in it, whereas Kevin lives in a part of Scotland called the Hebrides, right up in the northwest, and I think it's true to say that you're probably, in almost every sense of the word, further away from me than London is. So, you know, I mean, you really are quite far away from the central belt of Scotland, aren't you?
Oh, yes. And as far as numbers go, I think that the last count here, and this is Lewis and Harris combined, was 20,000, just slightly over 20,000 people. So, you know, we've not got a dense population up here either.
Indeed. No, the suburb in which I live has at least double that population. That's just the suburb I live. So, but it has struck me, actually, from my first-hand experience, not just of Lewis, but other islands, very different island, Orkney, that there again you see this, people are far more computer literate than you would expect. And I guess that's, I'd never thought about it until you said it, but you have to be, because you know, you only have another, well, you only got about another 19,999 people to socialise with.
Yeah, that's it, and you get bored of them very quickly, you know, you're absolutely sick of them. Yeah, so that was my very first experience, so with Ubuntu, and I, at the time, in my naivety, I thought, oh, well, you know, I'm quite happy with this, I'm going to stick with this. I'm not going to be one of these people who change. I became a complete and utter distro, but at one point, I think I was changing my distro every week. So I must admit, but I knew nothing, though, of the... I mean, to me, this was just an alternative operating system. It was not anything to do with freedom. It was nothing to do with FOSS. I didn't know what open source was. So it wasn't until I actually got involved with the Ubuntu forums, which I must admit, I really did find them quite good, that I actually started talking about different, I sort of started hearing about different things like open source, etc. I'm like, well, what's this open source stuff? It's like, hey, you're using the whole thing as open source. And I was like, oh, wow, that's brilliant. So it was through that, it was through coming to it, not because of that I came to it. It was actually through that, through the forums, people talking about it, that actually I was introduced to free software.
Ah, well, okay, then that's not that different from my story. Maybe that pattern is more common than I thought. And it's quite reassuring, if that is the case, that people are coming to it for the usability reason, first, and then making this extra discovery at the end of the freedom. So, just in this, the last little bit, you're talking about we discovered Ubuntu. Were you using Linux as a sort of a day-to-day thing? We actually did work, well, maybe not work at your work, but you were actually using it. You weren't just playing with it, or were you jumping back to Windows every so often to do other tasks?
No, I pretty much embraced it. In fact, I was using it, but I wasn't getting an awful lot of success on certain things. And it was just good timing. To be honest, this was, now there's a magazine in the UK, and a lot of people know it, Linux Format, and they at one point used to do an awful lot of specials. And it was about 6 months after I'd actually installed and was using Ubuntu, and I did dual boot. I kept Windows XP on my system for a wee while. And they released one saying, Linux made easy, dump Windows for good. It was a special. And I bought the magazine, and I used everything. I mean, it had gone through everything. I mean, some stuff that I couldn't find online, because almost, and I didn't want to ask because it seemed a bit basic. But they went through absolutely everything you do day to day and took us through it. And it was, to be honest, it was the good timing of that special and that magazine that made me then made a conscious effort to say, right, I am using this exclusively. And actually, at that point, I wiped Windows completely once I got so comfortable with it that I think there's not much I can't do that I need to do. And anything I can't do, well, the biggest thing was gaming. But even gaming, in the 90s, I was a big gamer. You know, I hadn't been for quite a while. So gaming was never really that big a deal to me personally. So, you know, it wasn't like I was giving up a huge part of my computing life for that. So it was the one thing. I mean, there's still some programs where I'm thinking, oh, I wish they'd come over to Linux or get a Linux port. But I put it this way, I'm surviving. I do not have Windows anymore on the machines at all. So I'm quite proud to say this is a Windows-free household.
Very good. Congratulations. I should also mention that the Linux Format magazine that you mentioned, probably the people that wrote those that special are probably now the same people who are over at Linux Voice, I would imagine.
Yeah, most of them. I seem to remember Paul Hudson was quite a big contributor to that one, and I know he's. I don't actually know where did Paul go. He moved on from Linux Format quite a long time ago.
Yeah. Okay. No, he didn't go to Linux Format. Certainly, no. He left Linux Format before. Yeah. So I'd forgotten about him. Yes, but that would have been that far back. Yeah.
Yes, aye. So there you go. So unfortunately, I didn't come for the noble cause and the freedom. But in saying that, once I found out about it, I did embrace those things. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm not a total diehard, and I certainly amn't going down the route of saying, oh, I have to, everything has to be free and open. But certainly if there is a free and open solution available, I will take it. I mean, it's... But at the same time, I don't want to say to myself, right, I'm totally limiting myself by saying I'm not going to use it for the likes of just things. For example, you know, I still do install Flash onto my system just to make the web a bit more usable. I still install Java, those kind of things. So, yeah, like I said, I've got the ability to play MP3s. Okay, all my music files are actually in OGG, but... Again, that was something else that Linux introduced me to. I'd never heard of OGG. I just always thought there was just MP3s or WAVs. That's my ignorance coming from a Windows background, though.
Yes, and I guess I was no different. So I suppose from the point where you left off with Ubuntu to the present day, a large part of your distro hopping is actually recorded for posterity in past Tux Jam episodes, isn't it?
Yes, although to be honest, there was probably before I even started Tux Jam, I was probably more prevalent, should I say, with distro hopping before then. What really settled me, and this may seem most people probably might shriek at this point, was I always fancied trying a build your own distro. So I think the first one I built was an Arch system. And at the time, Arch, I didn't know this about Arch, about how bleeding edge Arch was. And I installed it, it ran, and I had it for about a week, and I upgraded it, and everything broke. Just nothing worked after that. I thought, okay, right, that's maybe a bit too cutting edge for my liking. So then I went to Gentoo. Now, Gentoo, I ran and I loved. I really did like it. It was just something I loved how much control you had. I loved how much, you know, you could say what you wanted. And I ran that all the way up until GNOME 2 basically, it was classed as being finished and it died a death. And the problem I had with it then was Gentoo, when I'd installed everything myself and I chose what I wanted, was lightning faster than this computer. I mean, it was noticeably faster than anything else. The problem then was once GNOME 2 stopped, I thought, well, it's maybe a bit of a security risk if I keep using it. So I updated it and became GNOME 3. Hated that. I really just did not like it. And then I installed XFCE and I suddenly noticed, hey, wait a minute, this thing that was lightning fast, were you adding all these things to it, has become sluggish. And you're defeating the purpose of Gentoo here. And unfortunately, by that time, Wee Guy was in my life, and I just didn't have the time to actually think, right, I'm going to go and restart and rebuild. So it's been then I kind of moved. I thought, right, I've got to be something with a wee bit, so let's say, user-friendly and not quite as long to build. And the first one I used for a long time, actually, after was CrunchBang, the Debian-based one that was based on XFCE. And I installed that, used that, loved it. But I still wasn't entirely happy that it still came with a pre-loaded set of applications. I want to choose what I want. So then, after using that for quite a while, I then just installed Debian and built it up for myself. And that was pretty much it. I still run Debian. Now, I've got three other partitions here, which I do for testing different distros. Just like for the likes of Tux Jam, or if there's something else that takes my fancy. But apart from that, I've been on Debian for, let me think, probably the best part of 3 years now, which is very unusual for me. Most of my family are on either Mint or Ubuntu, so I do tend to keep a partition with Ubuntu on it, just so I can keep up to speed myself. But apart from that, Yeah, like I said, I've been pretty much stuck with Debian. I've stuck with Debian for the last wee while. Debian testing. I was on Unstable, and I had a bit of a disaster when something recently, I'm talking about in the last kind of 6 months, something recently updated which just seemed to break everything. So I just rebuilt the system up from scratch. But it's fun to do that now and again, and it's a heck of a lot quicker doing it in Debian than it is in Gentoo.
Yes. Well, that sounds like quite an adventure. I should point out again to listeners who are not familiar with it with us that WeeGuy isn't some kind of Linux-hating dwarf that hangs on with Kevy, but is in fact your son, isn't he?
Yes, he is. And, you know, it's amazing when little people come into your life, quite how much time they actually take up. And that's been the main reason I've never gone back to Gentoo, so I don't have the free time these days.
Yeah. I should mention that my son and my daughter, they've both grown up using a computer that, using my desktop computer that I'm recording this on, that runs Slackware with KDE, you know, and they just don't know. I mean, my son just switches between a Windows computer and a KDE, you know, KDE desktop. He doesn't really care. Just gets on with whatever he wants to do, completely oblivious to whatever operating system it is. And well, again, children are much more like that than adults.
Yeah, and that's what I think. If they can switch between them, and they can actually see the difference, this is where I think Linux could easily be a winner, because they see the difference. I mean, I even did that today. It kind of surprised me, because I switched on my work computer, went and got a cup of tea, was drinking it, came back, and it was still loading the flip up. It was like, I was just wanting to throttle the monitor, actually, to be honest. And then tonight, came in, switched on my own computer here, and stupidly was expecting to go and have a cup of tea and made up, and before it even got up and walked away, my desktop was in front of me and in a usable state. So I mean, when you see things like that, and when people actually see Linux being used as a day-to-day thing, all they've got, you know, it's a good enough ammunition to dispel the myth that, oh, Linux is impossible to use, because it's the same as pretty much anything else, point and click.
Yes, indeed it is. Indeed it is. So, any final remarks before we go on to our final tune?
No, nothing else. Just been an adventure, but I must admit, I would certainly not trade back. There is no way I'd go back to a Windows setup at all. I must admit, I really do love Linux. The only thing I would say was, if anybody was thinking about going or recommending somebody else move from Windows to Linux, the only thing I would genuinely say is two things. One, if they run into trouble, can they get a hold of you or someone else? Because as I found out, some older people especially, they're not that comfortable posting on forums. And the other thing is, if there's teenagers in the house, do they need the latest and greatest games? Because at present, although SteamOS may change this, I would say it probably would be safer to dual boot if that's the case.
Yes, that's a point. Yeah, my son does have to reboot into Shockwave or Windows XP. In fact, it's on this machine to play his favourite game on in Steam, because it's not available on Linux Steam. Yeah, so that's quite true. So what is our final tune?
Right, our final tune is by The Way I Am, and the tune is Answer My Call. And on that note, this brings us to the end of the show. Now then, if you'd like to contact us, you can contact the show. It's tuxjam@unseenstudio.co.uk. We're on various social media sites. We're on Twitter, joindiaspora.com. We're on micro.fragdev.com. And that's all at Unseen Studio there. But that's only for announcements. That's not really for a yarn. If you want to yarn with us, well, we're both available in various places. I'm at Kevy on micro.fragdev.com. I'm also at Kevy on diaspora.net.gr. And I am, unfortunately, at Kevy49 on Twitter. But to be honest, be expecting quite a delay in answering if you talk to me via Twitter, because I really don't check it very often. Now, Andrew's available on various parts of the web, so I'll pass you over.
Well, I think the best place to try and talk to me if you want to is on micro.fragdev.com, which is a GNU social status net platform, and I'm just called McNalu, MCNALU. I do exist with that name on Twitter, although you could try talking to me there, but I probably won't hear you, and I almost certainly wouldn't respond, so there's no point. So the best place would be there, or you could email me as mcnalu@mcnalu.net, and you can see my blog, which is at blog.mcnalu.net.
Yes, and that has pretty much come to the end. Now, this has been a special for HPR. Now, before I forget, one last thing is I was really pleased to see big news here for me, not for anybody else. The big news was my plane tickets finally came through for Podcrawl Glasgow. Now, Podcrawl Glasgow is going to take place on July the 11th. We hope to start at 6 p.m. at the State Bar, which is just off Sockey Hall Street. If you're on Sockey Hall Street and you're heading along to the campus bar, which has got a load of flags outside, it's directly across the road from there. So it's just on one of the perpendicular streets. I can't remember the exact name of that street just now, but it's there. So we hope to see you there. If you're thinking 6 p.m. is just too early, then follow on the various social media sites. We'll hashtag it with Glasgow Podcrawl. Or is it Podcrawl Glasgow? Which one is it? I can't remember.
I think it was Podcrawl Glasgow. Maybe we'll put both hashtags in just to be safe.
Yeah, maybe. So if you're thinking you'd like to join us up, then, like I said, just look for the hashtag and we'll find it where we are. So we'll probably move on. The only thing I will actually say, and I've said this a few times, with the nature of Glasgow public houses, it's not like the continent, and it's not even like in England where families are, you know, welcome and regularly attend. We are making this an over 18s only, just purely because the nature of public houses in Scotland, most of them only have child licenses till 7, and you do have to be 18, and you've got to be out by 7 or half 7 or something like that. So this is not really one to take the whole family to, unless they are all over the age of 18 years.
I think there you said join us up, which sounds a bit like we're getting married. That's not the case. Perhaps join up with us is probably the better form of words for that.
Yeah, guess who's the teacher here, huh?
I'm sorry, I'm a giant pedant, I admit it, sorry.
Right, so I'll really wind you up here by saying, so yous can all come and join us at the State Bar. It's 11th of July, Glasgow, 6 p.m. So we hope to see as many people as we can there. Now, it's not exclusively for just podcasters, it's also for podcast listeners as well. So generally, to be honest, as far as I'm concerned, it's anybody who really wants to come can come. If you like the Creative Commons music, if you like open source, if you like Linux podcasts, anything like that, then please do come along and you'll be made most welcome.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I'd love to see you there. In fact, I can now state that there will be one person, in addition to the two of us, that will definitely be there. So we're standing at a definite 3 at the very least.
Sounds good to me. And now, in fact, before I forget, you will actually be able to spot us quite easily. You may not know our faces. However, I'm in the process just now of getting T-shirts made up, and mine will have Kevy on the back of it. and Andrews will have McNallu on the back of it. So if you're really lost, look for the people, look for the two idiots standing there with their names on the back of the t-shirts.
Yes. Oh, I've forgotten about that. Yes, that's great. Yep.
Wow. Right then. So on that note then, it's a case of see you next time. So this has been a TuxJam special, an HBR exclusive. This is not available on the TuxJam feed. If you would like to subscribe to us and the show more on a more regular basis, then please head along to unseenstudio.co.uk and just search for the TuxJam, for TuxJam. So until episode 34, we shall see you then.
Yes, bye-bye, HPR folks.
Now, do you have the bumper, yeah?
Yes, yes, I've got the bumper. Good job we didn't mention that 33 and a third thing in Irish accents, eh?
Yeah, like you were saying, yeah. No, that wouldn't be good. A 33 and a third.
A 33 and a third. It's very good that we didn't do that at all. 33 and a third.
Oh, I haven't switched off the record button yet. Shall we edit this? Or we'll leave it as an outtake?
Well, we might as well also point out that whiskey is definitely not spelt with an E while we're at it.
Oh my word, no. That's just not right. Whiskey is spelt W-H-I-S-K-Y. Notice that? No E. I don't want E's in my whiskey. You get enough of a buzz of whiskey without adding E's to it.
I can. On that note, we shall really stop recording.
You have been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by a HPR listener like yourself. If you ever considered recording a podcast, then visit our website to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club. HBR is funded by the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. All Binrev projects are proudly sponsored by Lunar Pages. From shared hosting to custom private clouds, go to lunarpages.com for all your hosting needs. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution, Share Alike, 3.0 license.